Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Our speaker this time is the iconic writer, Margaret Atwood. She has written over 40 books, but is best known for her fiction. It was her novel, The Handmaid's Tale, that first gave her a wide global readership. Since then, she has published several international best-selling literary works and won the Booker Prize. Atwood has used her remarkable public profile to advocate for human rights, the environment, and the welfare of writers. She's been president of Penn International and helped found the Writers' Trust of Canada, to name just two of the organizations with which she has been active. As a public intellectual, Atwood is known as a brilliant thinker on a huge range of subjects, who has a wry and ironic sense of humor, and who is willing to call out platitudes and other forms of lazy thinking. Join us now for Margaret Atwood, here in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 1994.
It's a pleasure as well as an honor to be here as part of this friendly and well-run series. It amazes me these days that people will actually turn out to see and hear a writer. After all, we don't wear spangled suits and have backup groups, a deficiency which makes me feel guilty from time to time. I feel I should be offering more visuals. When people want to do TV shows on my life, I say, but what is there to see? Not much, because what a writer has to offer takes place mainly inside the heads of the readers. Nevertheless, it's very pleasant that you're all here, though I've recently developed the sneaking suspicion that writers should not give lectures, not just because they're too much like homework to prepare, but also because writers don't really have a field of expertise. Apart, of course, from their tricks of craft, which they are usually unwilling to discuss. In saying they don't really have a field of expertise, I'm not downgrading them, merely pointing out the obvious. Writers, particularly novelists, are among the last great generalists. If I were a dentist addressing fellow dentists, or a plumber among plumbers, you would perhaps learn something of use. As it is, what can I possibly have to say that you don't already secretly know? But being a writer, and although some of the patron gods of writers are the dignified and beautiful muses, another one is the dishonest Mercury, god of tricksters and thieves, I frequently engage, at least imaginatively, in pursuits of which I disapprove. So here I am giving, if not a lecture, at least something that might pass as one if you squint. My title is Spotty-Handed Villainesses. My subtitle is Problems of Female Bad Behavior in the Creation of Literature. I should probably have said, in the creation of novels, because it's my novelist's outfit I'm wearing at the moment. Female bad behavior may occur in lyric poems, of course, but not at very great length. Somebody has asked whether the spotty-handedness in my title referred to age spots. Was my lecture perhaps going to center on that once forbidden but now red-hot topic, the menopause? Without which any collection of female obilia would be incomplete. I hasten to point out that my title is not age-related. It refers neither to age spots nor to youth spots, once known as zits. Instead, it recalls that most famous of spots, the invisible but indelible one on the hand of wicked Lady Macbeth. Spot as in guilt, spot as in blood, spot as in outdamned. Lady Macbeth was spotted, Ophelia unspotted. Both came to sticky ends, but there's a world of difference. I'll get around to the spotty women in good time, but first let me go over some essentials which may be insulting to your intelligence, but which are comforting to mine, because they help me to keep my mind on what I'm supposed to be doing. If I may appear to be flogging a few dead horses, horses which have been put out of their pain long ago in some happy but sequestered circles, let me assure you that this is because the horses are not in fact dead, but are out there in the world galloping around as vigorously as ever. How do I know this? I read my mail. Also, on occasion, I listen to the questions that people ask me, both in interviews and during the question and answer periods after public readings. The kinds of questions I'm talking about have to do with what a writer should be doing and how the characters in a novel ought to behave. There is a widespread tendency to judge such characters as if they were job applicants or public servants or prospective roommates or somebody you're considering marrying. Let me underline the fact that the characters in novels are none of the above. And if they were, we would all be in deep trouble. What are they then, and how should we go about responding to them? Or from my side of the page, which is blank when I begin, how should I go about creating them? Which raises the further question, what is a novel anyway? Only a very foolish person would attempt to give a definitive answer to that, beyond stating the more or less obvious facts that it is a prose narrative of some length, which purports on the reverse of the title page not to be true, but seeks nevertheless to convince its readers that it is. As I said, Mercury is one of its patrons, and all writers are, among other things, con artists. But sometimes, when I find myself among readers, that is, among the trusting, I get confused, as I discover that such people are not treating me with the suspicion that I deserve. They are not hiding the silverware and disbelieving my claim that I'm actually the telephone repair person, as they ought to do. Instead, they invite me with great kindliness into their living rooms and expect me to act as some sort of cross between an old-time circuit rider and an astrologer and to solve their life problems for them. We con artists do tell the truth in a way, but as Emily Dickinson said, we tell it slant. By indirection, we find direction out. So here, for easy reference, is an elimination dance list of what novels are not. A novel is not a sociological textbook, although its true-to-life details must convince. If there's a brand of oven cleaner in it, that brand should actually have existed at the time. The toads in its imaginary garden must be real toads, but the garden is an imaginary one for all that. This is not, by the way, an argument for old-time realism, which left too much out. Nor is a novel a political tract, although politics, in the sense of human power structures, are germane to it. If its main design on us is to convert us to something, whether that something be Christianity, capitalism, a belief in marriage as the only answer to a maiden's prayer, or feminism, we are likely to sniff it out and to rebel. As André Gide once remarked, it is with noble sentiments that bad literature gets written. This is not to say that politics, in quotation marks, cannot form the substance of a novel. One of my own most favorite 19th century novels is Zola's Germinal. Another is George Eliot's Middlemarch. Both are highly political in an obvious way. But yet another is Wuthering Heights, which does not have any overt politics in it at all, though it could be read as a piece of subversion through and through. As I've said, novelists are a devious bunch. A novel is not a how-to book. It will not show you how to conduct a successful life, although some novels may be read this way. Is Pride and Prejudice about how a sensible middle-class 19th century woman can snare an appropriate man with a good income, which is the best she can hope for out of life given the limitations of her situation? Partly. But not completely. A novel is not a moral tract. Its characters are not all models of good behavior. Or if they are, we probably won't read it. A novel is, however, inextricably linked with notions of morality because it is about human beings, and human beings divide behavior into good and bad. The characters in a novel judge each other, and the reader judges the characters. However, the success of a novel does not depend on a not guilty verdict from the reader. As Keats said, Shakespeare took as much delight in creating an Iago, that arch villain, as he did in creating the virtuous Imogen. I would say probably more, and the proof of it is that I'd wager money you're more likely to know which play Iago is in. But although a novel is not a political tract, a how-to book, a sociology textbook, or a pattern of correct morality, it is also not merely a beautiful structure, a piece of art for art's sake, divorced from real life and its considerations, whether social or psychological. It cannot do without a conception of form and a structure, true, but its roots are in the mud. It may put out lovely lyrical flowers, certainly, but such flowers are built up out of the rawness of its raw materials. Novels are made of language, and language, being human, is messy. In short, the novel is ambiguous and multifaceted, not because it is perverse, although it may be that as well, but because it attempts to grapple with what was once referred to as the human condition, and it does so using a medium which is as slippery as a greased lawyer, and as stretchy as an old-time panty girdle, and as hard to pin down as a bowl of Jell-O, namely the language itself. Let me share with you, I know I'm on the West Coast, and that on the West Coast they do a lot of sharing with. Let me share with you some of the problems that beset the practicing novelist. Let us say the practicing female novelist, although what follows can be extended to the more innocent sex as well. Literary critics start usually with a text. They then address questions to this text, which they attempt to answer. What does it mean, being both the most basic and the most difficult? Novelists, on the other hand, start with the blank page, to which they similarly address questions. But the questions are different. Instead of asking, what does it mean, they ask, is this the right word, the right sentence, the right paragraph? The critic asks, what's happening? The novelist, what happens next? The critic asks, what kind of story is this? The novelist, what kind of story should this be? The critic asks, is this believable? The novelist, how can I get them to believe this? The novelist, echoing Marshall McLuhan's famous dictum that art is what you can get away with, says, how can I pull it off? As if the novel itself were a kind of bank robbery, whereas the critic is all too often liable to exclaim, in the mode of the policeman making the arrest, aha, you can't get away with that. In short, the novelist has to contend with the following questions. What kind of story shall I choose to tell? Is it, for instance, comic or tragic or melodramatic or all? How shall I tell it? Who will be at the center of it, and will this person be A, admirable, or B, not? And more important than it may sound, will it have a happy ending or not? No matter what you are writing, what genre and in what style, whether cheap formula or high-minded experiment, you will still have to answer, in the course of your writing, these essential questions. And unless you solve the problem of how to interest the reader, at least a few readers, you won't have any. What this means in actual fact is that any story you tell must have a conflict of some sort, and it must have suspense. This sounds like film writing 101, but it is nevertheless true for all that. Let's put a woman at the center of the story and see what happens, keeping in mind that art is what you can get away with, that is, you have to suck in the reader, and that conflict and suspense are necessary. Now there is a whole new set of questions. Will the conflict be supplied by the natural world? Is our protagonist lost in the jungle, caught in a hurricane, pursued by sharks? If so, the story will be an adventure story, and her job is to run away, or else to combat the snakes or whatever, displaying courage and fortitude, or else cowardice and stupidity. If there is a man in the story as well, the plot will alter in other directions. He will be a rescuer, an enemy, a companion in struggle, a sex bomb, or someone rescued by the woman. Once upon a time, the first would have been more probable, that is, more believable to the reader, but times have changed, and art is what you can get away with, and the other possibilities have now entered the picture. Stories about space invasions are similar, in that the threat comes from outside and the goal for the character, whether achieved or not, is survival. War stories per se, ditto, in that the main threat is external. Vampire and werewolf stories are more complicated, as are ghost stories. In these, the threat is from outside, true, but the threatening thing may also conceal a split-off part of the character's own psyche. Henry James' The Turn of the Screw and Bram Stoker's Dracula are in large part animated by such hidden agendas, and both revolve around notions of female sexuality. Once all werewolves were male, and female vampires, with the exception of Sheridan Le Fanu's Carmilla, were mere sidekicks to the male vampire. But there are now female werewolves, and women are moving in on the star blood-sucking rules, too. Whether this is good or bad news, I hesitate to say. Detective and espionage stories may combine many elements, but would not be what they are without a crime, a criminal, a tracking down, and a revelation at the end. Again, all sleuths were once male, but sleuthesses are now prominent, for which I hope they lay a votive ball of wool from time to time upon the tomb of the sainted Miss Marple. We live in an age not only of gender crossover, but of genre crossover, so you can throw all of the above into the cauldron and stir. Then there are stories classed as serious literature, which center not on external threats, although some of these may exist, but on relationships among the characters. This is where the questions really get difficult. As I've said, the novel has its roots in the mud, and part of the mud is history. And part of the history we've had recently is the history of the women's movement, and the women's movement has influenced how people read, and therefore what you can get away with in art. Some of this influence has been beneficial. For instance, whole areas of life that were once considered non-literary or sub-literary, such as the problematical nature of homemaking, the hidden depths of motherhood and of daughterhood as well, the once forbidden realms of incest and child abuse, have been brought inside the circle that demarcates the writable from the non-writable. Other things, such as the Cinderella ending, girl marries Prince Charming and lives happily ever after, have been called into question. As one lesbian writer remarked to me, the only happy ending she found believable anymore was the one in which girl meets girl and ends up with girl. But that was 15 years ago, and the bloom is off even that romantic rose. To keep you from being too depressed, let me emphasize yet once again that none of this means that you, personally, cannot find happiness with a good man, a good woman, or a good pet canary. Just as the creation of a bad female character doesn't mean that women should lose the vote. If bad male characters in novels meant that for men, all men would be disenfranchised immediately. We are talking about what you can get away with in art, that is, what you can make believable. When Shakespeare wrote his sonnets to his dark-haired mistress, he wasn't saying that blondes were ugly. He was just pushing against the notion that only blondes were beautiful. The tendency of experimental literature is to include the hitherto excluded, which often has the effect of rendering ludicrous the conventions that have just preceded the innovation. So the form of the ending, whether happy or not, does not have to do with how people live their lives. There is a great deal of variety in that department, and after all, in life, everything ends with death, which is not true of the novel. Instead, it has something to do with what literary conventions the writer is following or pulling apart at the moment. Happy endings of the Cinderella kind do exist in books, of course, but they have been relegated largely to genre fiction, such as Harlequin romances. To summarize some of the literary benefits of the women's movement, more inclusion, the expansion of the parameters available to writers, both in character and in language, a sharp-eyed examination of the way power works in gender relations, and the exposure of much of this as socially constructed, a vigorous exploration of many hitherto mysterious territories of experience. But as with any political movement which comes out of real oppression, I emphasize here real oppression, there was also, in the first decade at least of the present movement, a tendency to polarize morality by gender. That is, women were intrinsically good and men bad. To divide along allegiance lines, that is, women who slept with men were sleeping with the enemy, women who wore high heels and makeup were instantly suspect, defects in women were ascribable to the patriarchal system and would cure themselves once that system was abolished, and so forth. Such polarizations may be necessary to some phases of political movements, but they are usually problematical for novelists. If a novelist writing at that time was also a feminist, she found her choices self-restricted, or at least rendered more difficult. Were all heroines to be essentially spotless of soul, struggling against, fleeing from, or done in by male oppression? Was the only plot to be the perils of Pauline, with a myriad mustache-twirling villains, but minus the rescuing hero? Did suffering prove you were good? If so, think hard about this. Wasn't it all for the best that women did so much of it? Did we face a situation in which women could do no wrong, but could only have wrong done to them? Wasn't that just falling into the trap represented by the old children's rhyme about girls and boys, in which girls were made of sugar and spice and all things nice, and boys of snaps and snails and puppy dogs' tails, excuse the phallic symbolism? Were women being condemned yet again to that alabaster pedestal so beloved of the Victorian age, when woman, as better than man, gave men a license to be gleefully and enjoyably worse than women, while all the while proclaiming that they couldn't help it because it was their nature? Women were condemned to virtue for life, slaves in the salt mines of goodness. How intolerable. Of course, the feminist analysis made some kinds of behavior available to female characters, which under the old dispensation, the pre-feminist one, would have been considered bad, but under the new one were praiseworthy. A female character could rebel against social strictures, both sexually and in other ways, without then having to throw herself in front of a train. She could think the unthinkable and say the unsayable. She could flout authority. She could feel and express pain and anger. She could do new, bad, good things, such as leaving her husband and even deserting her children and living with another woman. Such activities and emotions, however, were, according to the new moral thermometer of the times, not really bad at all. They were good, and the women who did them were praiseworthy. I'm not against such plots. I just don't think they are the only ones. And there were certain new no-nos. For instance, was it at all permissible anymore to talk about women's will to power? Because weren't women supposed by nature to be communal egalitarians? Could one depict the scurvy behavior often practiced by women against one another, or by little girls against other little girls? Could one examine the seven deadly sins in their female versions to remind you? Pride, anger, lust, envy, avarice, greed, and sloth, without being considered anti-feminist? Or was a mere mention of such things, although we all knew they existed, tantamount to aiding and abetting the enemy, namely the male power structure? Were we to have a warning hand clapped over our mouths yet once again to prevent us from saying the unsayable, although the unsayable had changed? Were we to listen to our mothers yet once again as they intoned, "If you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all"? Hadn't men been giving women a bad rep for centuries? Shouldn't we form a kind of wall of silence around the badness of women, or at best explain it away by saying it was the fault of Big Daddy, or, permissible too it seems, of Big Mom? Big Mom, that agent of the patriarchy, that pronatalist, got it in the neck from certain 70s feminists, though mothers were admitted into the fold again once some of these women turn into them. In a word, were women to be homogenized, one woman is the same as the other, and deprived of free will, as in the patriarchy made her do it? Or in another word, were men to get all the juicy parts? Literature cannot do without bad behavior, as you will discover after 1 minute of reflection, or a reading of Samuel Richardson's supremely boring goodness novel, Sir Charles Grandison. But was all the bad behavior to be reserved for men? Was it to be all Iago and Mephistopheles, and were Jezebel and Medea and Delilah and Regan and Goneril and spotty-handed Lady Macbeth and Rider Haggard's powerful super femme fatale in She to be banished from view? I hope not. Women characters, arise. Take back the night. In particular, take back the queen of the night. It's a great part and due for revision.
You're listening to Margaret Atwood. She spoke during the 1993-94 season of Portland Arts and Lectures. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project.
To share with you again, I've always known that there were some spellbinding evil parts for women. For one thing, I was taken at the age of 5 to see Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Never mind the Protestant work ethic of the dwarfs. Never mind the tedious housework is virtuous motif. Never mind the fact that Snow White is a vampire. Anyone who lies in a glass coffin without decaying and then comes to life again must be. The truth is that I was paralyzed by the scene in which the evil queen drinks the magic potion and changes her shape. What power! What untold possibilities! Also, I was exposed to the complete, unexpurgated Grimm's fairy tales at an impressionable age. Fairy tales have had a bad reputation among feminists for a while, partly because they'd been cleaned up on the erroneous supposition that little children don't like gruesome gore, and partly because they'd been selected to fit the 50s Prince Charming is your goal ethos. So Cinderella and the Sleeping Beauty were okay, though the youth who set out to learn what fear was, which featured a good many rotting corpses, plus a woman who was smarter than her husband, were not. But many of these tales were originally told and retold by women, and these unknown women left their mark. There is a wide range of heroines in these tales. Passive good girls, yes, but adventurous, resourceful women as well, and proud ones, and slothful ones, and foolish ones, and envious and greedy ones, and also many wise women, and a variety of evil witches, both in disguise and not, and bad stepmothers and wicked ugly sisters, and false brides as well. The stories and the figures themselves have immense vitality, partly because no punches are pulled. In the versions I read, the barrels of nails and the red-hot shoes were left intact, and because no emotion is unrepresented. Singly, the female characters are limited and two-dimensional, but put all together, they form a rich five-dimensional picture. Female characters who behave badly can, of course, be used as sticks to beat women, though so can female characters who behave well. Witness the cult of the Virgin Mary, better than you'll ever be, and the legends of the female saints and martyrs. Just cut on the dotted line and minus one body part, there's your saint. And the only really good woman is a dead woman, so if you're so good, why aren't you dead? Women were once provided with numerous cautionary tales featuring bad behavior, followed by gruesome ends, as a warning to us to stay indoors and keep our noses, etc., clean. But female bad characters can also act as keys to doors we need to open and as mirrors in which we can see more than just a pretty face. They can be explorations of moral freedom, because everyone's choices are limited and women's choices have been more limited than men's, but that doesn't mean women can't make choices. Such characters can pose the question of responsibility, because if you want power, you have to accept responsibility, and actions produce consequences. I'm not suggesting an agenda here, just some possibilities, nor am I prescribing, just wondering. If there's a closed-off road, the curious speculate about why it's closed off and where it might lead if followed. And evil women have been, for a while recently, a somewhat closed-off road, at least for fiction writers. While I was writing this, I thought back over some bad female literary characters, not all written by women, it's true, but available to women now, because if a character has been written, she can always be rewritten. Witness Rochester's Mad Wife in Jane Eyre, rewritten by Jean Rhys in The Wide Sargasso Sea. If you were doing this on a blackboard, you might set up a kind of grid. Bad women who do bad things for bad reasons, good women who do good things for good reasons, good women who do bad things for good reasons, bad women who do bad things for good reasons, and so forth. But a grid would just be a beginning, because there are so many factors involved. For instance, what the character thinks is bad, what the reader thinks is bad, and what the author thinks is bad may all be different. Also, motivations, actions, and consequences may be quite separate. But let me define a thoroughly evil person as one who intends to do evil and for purely selfish reasons. The Queen in Snow White would fit that. So would Regan and Goneril, Lear's evil daughters. Very little can be said in their defense, except that they seem to have been against the patriarchy. Lady Macbeth, however, did her wicked murder for a conventionally acceptable reason, one that would win approval for her in corporate business circles. She was furthering her husband's career. She pays the corporate wife price, too. She subdues her own nature and has a nervous breakdown as a result. Similarly, Jezebel was merely trying to please a sulky husband. He refused to eat his dinner until he got hold of Naboth's vineyard, so Jezebel had its owner bumped off. Wifely devotion, as I say. The amount of sexual baggage that has accumulated around this figure is astounding, since she doesn't do anything remotely sexual in the original story, except put on lipstick. The story of Medea, whose husband Jason married a new princess and who then poisoned the bride and murdered her own two children, has been interpreted in various ways. In some versions, Medea is a witch and commits infanticide out of revenge, but the play by Euripides is surprisingly neo-feminist. There's quite a lot about how tough it is to be a woman, and Medea's motivation is commendable. She doesn't want her children to fall into hostile hands and be cruelly abused, which is also the situation of the child-killing mother in Toni Morrison's Beloved. A good woman, then, who does a bad thing for a good reason. Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles kills her nasty lover due to sexual complications. Here, too, we are in the realm of female as victim, doing a bad thing for a good reason, which, I suppose, places such stories right beside the front page, along with women who kill their abusive husbands. According to a recent Time story, the average jail sentence in the United States for men who kill their wives is 4 years, but for women who kill their husbands, no matter what the provocation, it's 20. For those who think equality is already with us, I leave the statistics to speak for themselves. These women characters are all murderers. Then there are the seducers. Here again, the motive varies. I have to say, too, that with the change in sexual mores, the mere seduction of a man no longer rates too high on the sin scale. But try asking a number of women what the worst thing is that another woman could possibly do to them. Chances are the answer will involve the theft of a sexual partner. Some famous seductresses have really been patriotic espionage agents. Delilah, for instance, was an early Mata Hari, working for the Philistines, trading sex for military information. Judith, who seduced the enemy general Holofernes and then cut off his head and brought it home in a sack, was treated as a heroine, although she has troubled men's imaginations through the centuries. Witness the number of male painters who have depicted her. Because she combines sex with violence in a way they aren't accustomed to and don't much like. Then there are figures like Hawthorne's adulteress Hester Prynne, she of the Scarlet Letter, who becomes a kind of sex saint through suffering. We assume she did what she did through love, and thus she becomes a good woman who did a bad thing for a good reason. And Madame Bovary, who not only indulged her romantic temperament and voluptuous sensual appetites, but spent too much of her husband's money doing it, which was her downfall. A good course in double entry bookkeeping would have saved the day. I suppose she is a foolish woman who did a stupid thing for an insufficient reason. Since the men in question were dolts. Neither the modern reader nor the author consider her evil, though many contemporaries did, as you can see if you read the transcript of the court case in which the forces of moral rectitude tried to get the book censored. One of my favorite bad women is Becky Sharp of Thackeray's Vanity Fair. She makes no pretensions to goodness. She is wicked, she enjoys being wicked, and she does it out of vanity and for her own profit, tricking and deluding English society in the process, which, the author implies, deserves to be tricked and deluded since it is hypocritical and selfish to the core. Thackeray obviously prefers Becky to the goody-goody Amelia and doesn't even punish her much at the end. She's a bad mother, too, and that's a whole other subject. Bad mothers and wicked stepmothers and oppressive aunts, like the one in Jane Eyre, and nasty female teachers, and depraved governesses, and evil grannies. The possibilities are many. But I think that's enough reprehensible behavior for you tonight. Life is short, art is long, motives are complex, and human nature is endlessly fascinating and inventive. Many doors stand ajar. What is in the forbidden room? Something different for everyone, but something you need to know and will never find out unless you step across the threshold. If you are a man, the bad female character in a novel may be, in Jungian terms, your anima. But if you're a woman, the bad female character is your shadow. And as we know from reading Hoffman, she who loses her shadow also loses her soul. I will leave you with two quotations. One is from the aptly named Lewis Hyde. Why is the trickster the messenger of the gods? The second is from Dame Rebecca West, speaking in 1912. Ladies of Great Britain, we have not enough evil in us. Note where the evil is located, in us.
If you'll pass your question cards forward, I'll bring them over.
Let's see now. How did you come up with the idea for the book of The Handmaid's Tale? Well, that's quite a long story. I think it came from various different sources. When I went to Harvard as a graduate student, I had to fill in my gaps. That's what they told us. And all of my gaps were filled in already, except for American literature. So I had to study a lot of American literature beginning in the 17th century, which was mostly sermons, and the 18th century, which there wasn't much of. I did study literature of the American Revolution, and the professor said, of course, there is no literature of the American Revolution because everybody was too busy revolting. So we're going to study literature just before the American Revolution and literature just after the American Revolution. And in the course of all this studying, I studied the 17th century Puritans and the theocracy that they set up in the Massachusetts Bay Colony and the laws that they instituted and the people they hanged. They were quite big on getting rid of people who didn't fit in. It's a big, it's a distortion of history to say that the Puritans came to North America to set up a democracy. This is not so. They set up a very hierarchical theocracy, and they got rid of anybody who didn't fit into it. They hanged Quakers. I can say this because they were my ancestors. So I can say bad things about them. And on the other hand, I was also studying dystopias and utopias from Plato's Republic, the Book of Revelations, up on through Sir Thomas More and into the 19th century, where there were lots of utopias, William Morris, for instance, and into the 20th century with Orwell and Brave New World. And I'm also one of those people who believes that people generally do what they say they're going to. Hitler said what he was going to do. It's all in Mein Kampf. People didn't take it seriously, but the agenda was right there for everybody to read. And people who say that women's place is in the home and therefore they should go back there, I think they really mean that, and that if they came to power they would go about instituting it. But then you ask, well, what are the means? There's grand ideas and then there's what actually happens. And how do you go about getting women back into the home now that they're all out there running around? I mean, it's sort of like corralling mice. I mean, how do you cram these scampering creatures back into the nest? Well, you make it impossible for them to have jobs or own property. You do away with prostitution, which is a source of income. And bingo, they're back in the home. In other words, you just reverse history by about 80 years. And there you have it. So those are some of the places that this book came from. I took great pains not to put anything into it that hasn't already been done in some society or isn't happening right now. I changed the location. I took some slight liberties with the clothing, although a number of societies have had very strict clothing laws, Calvinist Switzerland among them, and the Romans, who said that only patricians could wear purple. I got my costumes off the old Dutch cleanser package about 1948, which deeply traumatized me as a child. These women whose heads were hidden by these huge, enormous white headdresses, holding a stick in one hand, and in the other hand, another box of old Dutch cleanser with another woman on it with a stick, and another box of old Dutch cleanser. This is, I'm not the only child of that time who was very disturbed by this, I found out recently. It wasn't just the stick, it was the infinite regression. So the costume made a deep impression on me, and I changed it to red for many good reasons. Among them, the fact that German prisoners of war in Canada were made to wear red uniforms because they would show up so well against the snow. That's just one of the reasons. So nothing is in there that hasn't existed, including the group hangings. It's all been done. I suppose you might say that the book came out of a study of history, although it's a book about the future. The other part of the question was, did I have anything to do with the movie? Well, not very much. Writers don't usually have much control in movies unless they produce them and put up the money. And I did not do that, so I didn't really have a lot of control, although I was the only historical consultant available. If they wanted to know what people had for breakfast, they had to ask me. And I did visit the set for one day. That's about all you can take of a movie being shot. You know, it's very slow, movie shooting. Movie making is a lot more like mosaic making than it is like a stage play. They make movies in little bits and then they stick all the bits together. And that means that the scenes are played out of sequence and over and over again until it's a wonder these people don't all go mad. If you weren't a writer, what would you be? I used to think ballerina, but I think that's probably... time for that has gone by. And anyway, I always got dizzy on the turns. To be a little bit more serious, I probably would have been a botanist, or I might have been a painter. Those were the two things that were occupying my time. I made the mistake in grade 9 of not taking typing. I could have taken typing. Our choices were typing, art, and home economics. And I was warped by the guidance book. The guidance book in 1952 proposed 5 careers for women, only 5, count them. They were secretary, airline stewardess, nurse, teacher, and home economist. And I did not wish to be any of those things when I was 12, which was the age I was in first year high school. Due to the lamentable policy of skipping people, I was this midget in a classroom of tall, hairy, sweaty 15-year-olds. So I didn't want to be any of those things, but I looked at the pay scales, and being a mercenary child, I saw that the home economists made the most. So if I couldn't be something I wanted to be, but had to be something else instead, I felt I might as well make the most money doing it. So I did go into home economics. I can put in a zipper very well. I had some philosophical differences with the home economics teacher. She was interested in what the clothes looked like on the inside. She also had this idea about food, that each dinner plate should have on it a green thing, a yellow thing, a white thing, and a brown thing. And apart from that, it didn't much matter what they tasted like, and you shouldn't lick the spoon. So there was that. However, I was good enough at it so that I was my high school's entrant in the Consumer Gas Miss Homemakers contest. In which I had to iron a shirt, cook a meatloaf, and some third thing I've repressed.
That was Margaret Atwood, the iconic Canadian novelist, poet, and critic. She spoke during the 1993-94 season of Portland Arts and Lectures. You've been listening to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers over the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any of the other talks in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.